On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the news this week, toil and trouble on the planet and off. In the Middle East, the West Bank and Gaza torn apart.
The Palestinian dream of an independent state is in tatters tonight.
In Washington, a subpoena for Harriet Myers hits the Bush inner circle.
It's now up to the president. Is he going to cooperate with an investigation that has really rocked the Justice Department, brought out facts that we have never seen before, or are they going to continue to stonewall?
And in the heavens, astronauts scramble as a key computer goes out on the space station.
The real issue here is these Russian computer failures have knocked out the Russians' ability to control the station.
We have a lot of territory to cover this week and a terrific panel to guide us. Ragida Dargham is senior diplomatic correspondent and columnist for Al Hayat, one of the top newspapers in the Arab world. It's based in London. She joins us from New York. Ragida Dargham, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
From Washington, just days back from a European jaunt with the president, we're joined by Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Richard Wolff, welcome back. Great to have you.
Tom, good to be with you again.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom, Richard, and Ragida.
Ragida, first to you. What do you see in this remarkable scene in Gaza and through that the West Bank? Is it a whole new world when it comes to the Palestinians? What's the meaning of this civil war, I guess?
I guess it looks like a civil war, but one hopes not, obviously, because everybody will suffer. For the moment, it is still a war between factions, the leaders of factions. There has been many contributors to this terrible demise. Some are states in the region which are radical, and they want a proxy war not only in Palestine but also in Lebanon and Iraq for their own purposes. And on the other hand, we have failure of policies and failure of will, if you don't mind me saying that, because the United States had given a lip service really to the Palestinians, and Israel has not delivered at all, has not been ready actually to make peace with the Palestinians. So as a result of these forces in the region and outside the region, we have had a victory for Hamas, unfortunately. This victory is in Gaza right now. It's a military victory, but I'm not so sure it will translate into a political victory on the long run. I think Hamas, in a way, has set itself up in not a very pretty place. Now, in the meantime, President Mahmoud Abbas, if he does the right thing and if they consolidate the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, maybe things will look better.
It's dissolved? The unity government dissolved, a state of emergency declared, Hamas taking over one facility after another until now. Really, it has Gaza in its hands. People dragged out, Fatah people dragged out and shot in the streets.
That is why I don't think the unity government, many people think that, well, let's get it back together. Well, it's a Humpty Dumpty, really. I don't think it's possible, at least not immediately. I believe that the Palestinian president named Salam Fayyad as a temporary prime minister, and I know Salam Fayyad, he is the man who is known as the anti-corruptor, the man who fights corruption, if you will, in Fatah and other Palestinian Authority places. So in a way, this is a good first move. The Arab League, of course, is trying to search for something. I'm not so sure they can come up with something immediately doable. The Mecca agreement, if you would remember, this is the one that was hosted by Saudi Arabia.
Right in the middle of it.
And that produced, of course, the unity government. Before that, President Mahmoud Abbas, when I saw him last in Davos, actually saw him afterwards, but when I saw him in Davos in January, he was speaking about the possibility of having to call for legislative and presidential elections should there not be a success of the attempt to bring about a unity government.
Right.
And at that point, something very important was hoped to be cooked, if you will, between the Israelis and the Arab moderates. But unfortunately, yet again, the warning came very clear from Arab leaders. If you remember that King Hussein, King Abdullah of Jordan had come to Washington to the Joint Congress and he said, help us out before it's too late. We need to do something. And he warned us. He said a looming disaster is going to be a regrettable situation for all. And that's exactly what happened.
Ragida, stand by. I want to hear some tape from there now. Of course, we have Ehud Olmert, the Israeli leader, headed to Washington this weekend. And Richard Wolff, I want to hear you on that. But we have seen the scenes in Gaza. I mean, the mansions of some of these Fatah leaders stripped right down to the bathroom tiles, the poor going in salvaging wood and metal out of Mohammed Dahlan, the security chief's big house in Gaza. Let's listen to the sounds coming out of the region. Here's Chief Palestinian Negotiator Saab Erekat saying the help which Palestinians have been requesting for years won't come unless the infighting ends.
What we need to say to the world now, we need to stop this fire, we need to extinguish this fire, we need the help to have a ceasefire, and if we don't do this, if we don't help ourselves as Palestinians, I don't think anybody can.
But so far, the West Bank and Gaza simply torn apart. Here's Sanir Huleila, former aide to Abbas, telling NPR's Linda Gradstein that Abbas has failed to provide leadership and must face Hamas head on.
This is a very serious coup against the legitimacy. And this cannot be faced with some talks and words. What you're seeing is on the ground, they are trying to create new realities based on a coup kind of position and not democratic position.
We've got the Islamic spokesman for the Hamas militia telling Hamas radio triumphantly the era of justice and Islamic rule have arrived in Gaza. Then on Thursday, a spokesman Osama Hamdan said the goal was not an Islamic Gaza, but rather to enforce the agreed-upon security plan.
We are not talking about Islamic Gaza. We are talking about applying the security plan which was endorsed by the government. We are talking about applying the Mecca Agreement, which includes power sharing, a national unity government, and which includes also the chance for all the groups to participate either in the government or in the political life.
Pretty talk, but the tearing is done. Gaza and West Bank now under very different kinds of control. Olmert headed to the White House this weekend, Richard Wolff, to sit down with President Bush. What do you imagine that conversation will be like?
Well, a desperate one, frankly. I mean, this is a disaster for all sides. Ehud Olmert has obviously got incredibly low ratings and standing anyway. Remember, it was his own party under Ariel Sharon that executed the Gaza withdrawal. Ragida said the Israelis had done nothing, but actually they withdrew their settlers, which was deeply controversial, and they handed Gaza over. And partly as a result of that, partly as a result of Palestinian politics, and also, Ragida is absolutely right, the result of American and Israeli approach to the Hamas government, this has turned into a complete fiasco, anarchy, and of course, it is civil war. So how are they going to approach it? I suspect, knowing President Bush and knowing Prime Minister Olmert's situation, they're going to try and see this as something of an opportunity. President Bush has a way of trying, at least in his own mind, to see bad news as good news, a testing time. And his moment of opportunity, as we're seeing already from the White House, is to say, well, this is now freeing us up. This split between Hamas and Fatah is freeing us up to support Abbas, President Abbas, in a way that we couldn't do before. Let's get the tax revenues that the Israelis have been withholding to Abbas in the West Bank. Let's show that Abbas can actually have something of a government, a functioning Palestinian authority, and do things that they haven't done before, which is try and help him to deliver something provable and demonstrable to the Palestinian people. It hasn't worked before. Maybe it'll work now. I think you have to be an incorrigible optimist to think it'll work.
Jack Beatty, pull back the curtain here a little bit. We've got something like civil war, this amazing West Bank almost now set against Gaza. But look around. In Lebanon, a big bombing this week, another politician in opposition to Syria and his son and others blown up in the streets of Beirut. You've seen the trouble in Iraq this week. Iran still on a tear. Afghanistan not doing so great. I mean, what is going on here, Jack? This is hardly the picture that was painted when we waded into our hips here.
No, and partly it's at least part of this is in reaction to our action, and you know what's really worrisome in this Palestinian matter is the war by proxy. We're supplying one side, the Palestinian Authority, and Iran through Egypt is apparently supplying weapons to the other side. And where that goes, one doesn't want to look. I mean, this week, Mohammed El-Baradei warned that essentially crazies on either side, Iran or the United States, could provoke a confrontation. We had Senator Lieberman come out on Sunday and say, well, the United States should think about attacking Iran. We have Mr. Cheney's men are going around to the American Enterprise Institute and other redoubts of neoconservatism and saying, listen, don't listen to Rice. That doesn't represent what Bush wants. We are going to have a confrontation with Iran. And meanwhile, on the Democratic side, you have almost a green light for an attack on Iran. The Democrats would not put a limit on, essentially would not include in their legislation on Iraq a proviso that the president has to come to Congress for approval to attack Iran. And Hillary Clinton sounds a little bit like Cheney on the subject. So it's a very worrisome development. And as 2008 approaches, the political temptation to do something with Iran is going to grow stronger and stronger.
A lot of astonishing news this week on Earth and in the heavens with that space shuttle. Let's go to a caller, Andy, in Somerville, Massachusetts. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to point out something that potentially is not really looked at. If you look at Lebanon, Jordan, and quite a few other Arab countries in the area, you see that there are lots of Palestinian refugee camps.
That have been for a long time.
For 40 years, and they're still considered refugees. And if you drill down, some of the countries provide detailed information about the camps, you see that for a population of 40,000 people, you have one police station, one post office, one school, and 14 mosques. And then you start thinking, wait a minute, why are people being radicalized? How could that be? Well, isn't that an answer? I'd be very happy to hear your comments on that.
40 years in the camps, and we'll pick that up. Let me get one more call before we do. Sumner, calling from East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Sumner, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I wanted to make two quick points.
Yes.
One is that Hamas has been in power for more than a year, and the most that they've ever offered has been, I think, what they call a hudna, which is basically a truce with Israel, but not a recognition. They've had all this time to agree to recognize Israel, and I think if they had done so, American policy would have changed. The second point is the common denominator in all of these problem areas, Lebanon, Palestine, Iraq, is Iran, and we have to deal with the regime one way or another, because if we don't do it now, it's only going to get worse. These people are motivated.
What do you mean by deal with the regime? What do you mean by deal with them, Sumner?
We have to engage in regime change, even if it requires force. Because
you mean Israeli tanks back in Gaza, that kind of thing?
I'm talking about Iran.
Iran, okay. Iran,
Iran is, in fact, the common denominator between Hamas, Hezbollah, the problems in Iraq and now apparently troubles in Afghanistan and Pakistan as well.
Sumner, let us pick those up. That's a big piece. Richard Wolff, let me come first to you, and then Ragida, I'll be right there. But looking out from the White House, we didn't hear much from Condoleezza Rice as all of this seemed to blow up this week. Richard, from the White House, you know, there's first a caller saying, well, what do you expect when you've got all these poor Palestinians for all these decades? And then the caller saying, well, Iran is behind all of this. People are describing Gaza now as a new equivalent of southern Lebanon, where Hezbollah has become so entrenched and militarily effective, Israel found out last year. What about the White House eyeing Iran's hands here? You hear Jack Beatty's suggestion that they may, the vice president anyway, might like to lunge for that.
Yes. I mean, I hate to point out the obvious here, but regime change in Iraq has hardly gone well. So, and the White House is not oblivious to that point. If there are options for military action in Iran, it's really focused on the nuclear threat. Regime change is just not possible for this White House, for this administration, and arguably for any administration when it comes to Iran, given a lack of engagement with Iran, a lack of understanding, a lack of intelligence. White House officials at the highest level will say they don't really understand Iranian politics, the different factions, never mind the security powers and the security forces behind the nuclear program. But there are
strong analysis inside the administration to say that these are proxy wars, whether it's Lebanon, Iraq, or among the Palestinians. But how you deal with that is something is a different challenge, and their giant mistake, if you can ascribe any blame here to the administration in terms of the rise of Hamas, is to allow Hamas to participate in elections without renouncing violence and without accepting Israel's right to exist. And then, once Hamas had won power, saying they should never have been part of the elections and they couldn't be recognized as a government. I mean, that's an internal contradiction which has directly led, or at least contributed, to what we're seeing right now, which is this collapse of the Palestinian Authority.
Raghida Durgam, so here you have it. Hezbollah still in southern Lebanon, now Hamas running Gaza, and we saw the bombing in Lebanon this week in Beirut of another anti-Syria politician dead. What does this mean for Israel? What does it mean for the Palestinians? Lebanon.
Let me, if I may, just take on a couple of issues related to the Palestinians first, because Lebanon is really an important subject that I'd like to give it its own time, if you don't mind. In as far as the refugees, of course, the refugees have been radicalized in the camps, but also the Palestinians under occupation have been radicalized because of living under occupation. So the problem, in effect, is the fact that we have not arrived practically and seriously at the two-state solution. It is not enough to, and I agree, it's an important point Richard makes, that the Israelis should release the tax revenues. But these are important but not important enough of measures. What the President of the United States needs to do is to take a firm decision that he wants this two-state solution to succeed, and in order for him to do that, he would have to be courageous enough to pressure Israel as well. Enough of this blame game that goes only one way. Hamas, of course, is now responding to the opportunity prevailed for Hamas. That is to say, Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority president, had not gotten enough support. He did not get political support. He did not get practical support. And he's been cornered by the promises and empty promises.
Enough support from who? Maybe there weren't enough Palestinians
supporting him. Well, actually, the Palestinians are divided. We know that. But in order for him to win the moderates and to show something for having chosen the route of negotiations and a two-state solution, he needed at least, Tom, at least that the Israelis agree to sit with him and negotiate the final status of the territories. The Israeli side had never agreed to do that, despite all the, you know, ways and means that everybody's talking about it. But that was the bottom line. If there is to be any good result from the Olmert meeting in Washington with Bush, it should be to say, we need to rescue right now. If we are serious, we need to do something about the final status and grab the moment, the opportunity, as Richard called it, in order to do something substantive, not lip service again and doctoring over things.
Raghida, turn to Lebanon, your home country, and the bombing there. What is going on there?
What is going on is actually really, again, it's the access of Iran, Syria, Hezbollah on one hand in Lebanon, and Hamas, of course, in Palestine. You have Khaled Mishal, who is a Palestinian leader of Hamas, sitting in Damascus and dictating what's going on in the Palestinian territories, in as far as Gaza is concerned. But in fact, what is happening is that Syria got terribly angry with an establishment of the tribunal, international tribunal for ending
the Hariri
impunity.
Murder.
Exactly. Hariri, the former prime minister of Lebanon, who was assassinated. And, of course, there was 14 other assassinations and assassination attempts thereafter. And this tribunal basically was forced by a Security Council resolution under Chapter 7 because there were maneuvers to block it by the parliament in Lebanon. So when it became a reality, I think Syria panicked. I don't know why they're panicking so much.
If they can just reach in and kill anybody in Lebanon anytime? I mean, can Lebanon hold together with this kind of pressure?
I tell you, I am not pessimistic about Lebanon, Tom. I'm going to tell you this is a surprising position I'm taking probably to some. But I think this is the only success story that is possible for George W. Bush if he stays the course in Lebanon. Because he's not doing it alone. He is with the international community. His action is with based on resolutions of the Security Council and in support of the majority in Lebanon and a democratic government at that. So, Prime Minister of Lebanon, Fuad Sanyura, is probably the only success story left for George W. Bush. And if there is an intent on being very firm with the Syrians and the Iranians on the issue of Lebanon, Lebanon might not fall into collapse and chaos like what might happen, like is happening in Gaza. And that will require of this administration to get it together, excuse me, to say. We can't have Rice appealing to the Iranians, please come and meet with me, and Cheney saying, oh, well, you know what, I'm preparing for war. We really need to understand what does this administration want.
Raghida, hold the thought. We've got a lot of ground to cover. I want to turn to Iraq. We saw the big blasts there this week, of course, back in Samarra, where the Golden Dome went last year. Now two more minarets, even with all the security laid on there. Here's Muqtada al-Sadr on Wednesday blaming the mosque bombing on occupation forces and the Iraqi government.
As a matter of course, the occupation tries to trigger an explosion of sectarianism in Iraq. Blowing up the holy shrines, whether Sunni or Shia, is a potent element in triggering this sectarian explosion. Therefore, the bombing of the Askari shrine in Samarra is aimed at provoking even more the Shia's feelings. We hold the occupation and the Iraqi government responsible for security, including in Samarra.
Though everybody says more likely al-Qaeda did, I should say that was a spokesman for Muqtada al-Sadr. We also had this week commander of the Multinational Security Transition Command in Iraq, Martin Dempsey, testifying on Capitol Hill saying Iraqi police and military are not ready to take over from U.S. forces.
I heard General Abizaid say 3 years ago that there would undoubtedly at some point in this mission be a point of descending consent where the population would either want to be completely in control of their own destinies or begin to blame us for the failures of their government. And I think we have to be alert for that point. I don't think we're there yet, but it's certainly we certainly need to keep our eye on that.
Be alert for that point, he says. Let's go to Hendersonville, Tennessee, and Bob. Bob, you're on the air.
Tom, how are you?
Very well.
I wanted to tell you first, you're the best that there is in radio, period.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to give you just a couple of things. One thing, instead of building a wall, why don't they activate the law that says every corporation has to check on their internet when the guy's hired to find out if he's a citizen or not.
So you're on immigration, build an electronic wall, a database, and control it that way, you say?
That's all you have to do.
Okay.
That's the whole thing. And the other thing I wanted to know, how come Bush said it took over 5 years to train Iraqi soldiers that were 240,000 strong that fought the first war and the second war, and all of a sudden they're not trained good enough? For 5 years, they've been sending Americans over there to die to take their place while they hide out.
It is getting to be a long time. Well, look at that. Jack, there's always been the idea, the Vietnamization equivalent here. Turn it over to the Iraqis. But we don't see that going on. And you heard the commander right there saying, as time goes on, without that happening, blame for the whole mess among Iraqis is more and more placed on Americans themselves, even after all the blood and treasure spent.
Yes, it is. You know, according to one study, 1 in 6 of the U.S. trained police are either go missing or are killed. 1 in 6. There are more suicide bombings in the country as a whole now than before the surge. According to another estimate, 500 Iraqis, which would be 3,000 or more Americans, die every day, as many as a third by U.S. forces. So, yeah, we're the idea of turning it over to the security forces. The fact is that the sectarianism of the security forces, especially the police, is it's just a huge stumbling block. And to the degree that we, you know, people say we're in the middle of a civil war, really we're supporting one side in the civil war.
But they've been working hard to get Sunnis back in the game, recruiting police out in Anbar and all that. I mean, trying to make it a two-sided game
with some balance, isn't that the point? That is the point, but now we're arming some Sunni tribes there, and, you know, how does that look on the Shiite side? I mean, is this just not getting ready for the full-scale civil war? Mm. Events seem to have never been under control, but now they have a dynamic all their own. And, of course, the other part of it is our bases. And a study on that shows that, you know, we're building permanent works there, some of them on large scale, and the Iraqis understand what that means, and they don't want it. That means a permanent U.S. president.
Raghida, I hear you there.
Yeah, I wanted to say something about the Iraqi situation. I was speaking to the foreign minister of Iraq, Hoshyar Zibari, yesterday. He's here in New York, and he's heading to Washington. And he is talking about his confidence that there would be no abandonment by the American forces of Iraq, to use his word, but there would be adjustment. And I guess what he is talking about is this basis, and they are working together with the government of Iraq. I think the government of Iraq will want these bases. The trouble is that...
So the foreign minister can live there with his family, perhaps?
Well,
the
point is that they do not believe, he does not believe that the United States can really afford to cut and run. He does not think that this is going to happen. He believes that there will be an adjustment of the American presence. He understands there are timelines and pressure of timelines, particularly in September, because there are major reports coming. But he feels that they are doing, they're meeting some of these benchmarks. But quite honestly, I don't see how Mr. Maliki, Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister of Iraq, is really meeting these benchmarks when the militias, the Shiite militias, are still quite close to him, and they are still operating. That is why I don't know what Jack meant, but I am against the armament by any of the parties there. However, if you have the militia of Muqtada al-Sadr, an ally of, in practice, of Nouri al-Maliki, then what are you going to do with the Sunnis there?
Well, you can't build an army without arms. Richard Wolff, how does this look from the White House? We heard talk not many months ago that there we'd surge and then crank down next year. It would look good in advance of the 08 elections. Or what? Now we're at a peak of the surge. Is there a way to stay the course or on to Iran? I mean, what's your sense of how they're looking out on this situation?
Well, in spite of the public statements of confidence and voicing of progress in Iraq, behind the scenes there's a full understanding of how dismal the situation is and how bleak the outlook is in Iraq. When you ask if they're going to stay the course, I don't think there's any question. This president is not going to engineer a full withdrawal on his watch. There will still, in my opinion, be around 100,000 troops in Iraq when he leaves office in January 2009. Having said that, Raghida is right in quoting these Iraqi opinions that there will be an adjustment, meaning, I guess, some limited drawdown of American troops, some symbolic maybe, but also significant. You could take out 30 to 50,000 troops just on the rotational adjustments, and it would be significant for American public opinion, but not really change the mission, as it were. Now, as to that mission, there is, I think, some disarray inside the administration, a feeling that the concentration on the surge, which has been about embedding troops in these forward deployed positions in these neighborhoods, has taken away from training. So they're going to try and train more troops now.
We're looking at a hot week in the news with Richard Wolff of Newsweek magazine, Raghida Durgam of Al Hayat, a big Arab newspaper based in London, and our own Jack Beatty. Lots going on this week. The Palestinian breakup, a subpoena for Harriet Myers, immigration rising maybe, and more. The Duke prosecutor went on trial this week.
The public perception is that the justice system in North Carolina has no integrity. This didn't have to happen.
So much for lacrosse. Here's no game. Scooter Libby is headed for jail.
Judge Walton has just ruled that Scooter Libby is denied his motion to stay out of jail pending his appeal.
And the San Antonio Spurs sweep the Cleveland Cavaliers to win the NBA championship.
And there's the buzzer. The San Antonio Spurs are NBA champions once again. Their fourth title in 9 years.
Richard Wolff, everybody laughed when George Bush sat down for lunch with the senators, but immigration is back on the table, it appears, as the weekend.
Yes, I think actually there's fairly good chances that this will actually move forward.
How did he do that?
Well, remember that his challenge isn't really with Democrats here. His position is very close to the opposition party. His problem is with his own party, and his own party is split. There's a minority of them that are moderate Republicans who want to be on his side, on the Democratic side of the immigration debate. The question is whether they can move that forward, whether they can drop the all the sort of procedural amendments that were blocking things, the poison pills. I mean, it's almost about solving the parliamentary tactics that were going on and moving forward. So I think that if you just sort of add up the votes, he has the votes to do it. The question is whether he can drop the sort of obstructionist tactics from people in his own party, and that's his challenge. I don't think it's a done deal, but it's certainly looking more likely.
A promise of billions more for border security up front to make you maybe break the logjam. Let's listen in a little bit here to some of the comments this week. We've got here Senator Ted Kennedy and Republican John Kyle announcing a compromise that will bring the immigration bill back to the Senate, allowing senators to consider amendments. Let's listen to Kyle.
Doing nothing is not an alternative. It's not an alternative. This issue isn't going away.
If we don't try, this problem that has bedeviled us for years will continue.
Ted Kennedy and John Kyle right there saying, we've got to do something here. Earlier Thursday, President Bush proposed measures he hoped would appease conservative critics.
I support an amendment that will provide $4.4 billion in immediate additional funding for securing our borders and enforcing our laws at the work site.
It will not be an easy sell for Alabama's Jeff Sessions, vocal opponent of the bill.
I have not changed my mind because of the fundamentals. Now, could something break and could some changes occur? I guess it's possible. But frankly, I think in a rush environment, like in a few days, something's got to break. I doubt that can occur.
Jack Beatty, where do you see this driving? You hear Kyle and Kennedy saying, we can't go on as it is. Sessions still saying, I don't think so.
That's the problem. Sessions and a few others, including the two Texas senators, don't want any bill at all. And some of their amendments may, in fact, have the effect of killing the bill if they draw enough Democrats to support them. A recent poll, the Wall Street Journal this morning, points out that 75% of Republicans say it's not realistic to think that these 12 million illegals can be sent home, that some sort of path to citizenship makes sense. And yet, at the same time, the overall support for the bill is about 30%. So people, even Republicans, overwhelmingly accept that there has to be something like a creeping amnesty for these people living in the shadows. But on the other hand, they don't like this bill. So it's a strange. It has popular support if you look at it one way. But on the other hand, again and again in our politics, things that have broad support but not intense support are hostage to very passionate objections from minorities, especially in the Senate, of course, where the threshold is 60 votes.
But that immigration reform bill, it appears, climbing out of that coffin it looked like it was in last week, and maybe as early as next week, back on the floor of the Senate for amendments and all the rest. At the same time, we've got this standoff, Richard Wolff, between Congress, the Democratic Congress, and the White House over Harriet Myers. Democrats want to know what the White House knew about the fired U.S. attorneys, issued a subpoena this week to former White House counsel, George Bush's good old friend Harriet Myers. There were strong words from Senate Judiciary Chairman Patrick Leahy of Vermont.
It's now clear from the evidence gathered by the investigating committees, the White House officials played a significant role in originating, developing, coordinating, and implementing the plan and the Justice Department's response to congressional inquiries about it.
Their hands were all over it, he says. White House Press Secretary Tony Snow said Democrats are playing politics with the probe.
If you really are trying to get the facts, you will accept access to all the key players and all the key documents. If, in fact, you're looking for something else, such as a media circus, you're going to adopt a different approach.
Richard Wolff, will the White House deliver Harriet Myers or go to the mat over the subpoena, defy the Democratic Congress?
They will never deliver Harriet Myers or anybody else. I can promise you that. That you played that clip right at the top of the show about from Chuck Schumer saying, will they stonewall? Yes, they will, is the answer. And the reasons are complex, but in a way quite simple. Yes, there's some politics there. They don't want to get pushed around. But a lot of it comes down to the personal angle of this. Having gone through the Valerie Plame inquiry and seen how that can drag on and mount up in terms of legal costs for these individual White House officials, both former and current, there's a huge wariness about going down this route again. Yes, these congressional investigations are difficult and awkward, and they can be dragged out. But the nightmare scenario is that Alberto Gonzalez goes, a new attorney general comes in, mm-hmm. and he or she appoints an independent counsel. And that would go on forever and cost them millions, both individually and collectively. They don't want to do that. So it goes beyond the personal loyalty and the politics.
But what happens with that subpoena? Congress has issued it. So as a matter of course and process and balance of powers, Richard Wolff, what happens to it now?
It gets fought.
Just sits on the White House doorstep and gets some muddy in the rain.
She can show up and say nothing. I mean, there's plenty of opportunities, as the Clinton and White House discovered. There are plenty of ways to avoid cooperating, but technically not be in breach.
Jack Beatty,
and that's where they're going to live.
Yeah, no vote of no confidence permitted on Alberto Gonzalez. Richard Wolff says, you know, not a snowball's chance that they'll really show up and testify here. So does this just does this one molder in the grave? The whole Justice Department, Harriet Myers imbroglio.
Well, that seemed to be what Tony Snow was starting to say earlier this week. But, you know, there are other dynamics at work, at least as regards the Attorney General. An internal investigation now is looking at the possibility of witness tampering by our Attorney General, his seeming coaching of Monica Goodling in March. Remember when he brought her in and yep. said, well, now, what's your recollection of this? My recollection is this. It looked like possible witness tampering. That's, of course, a serious offense, and he's under investigation by his own department. You know, he's a disgrace, and it's an insult to the country that this man is still in office, and it's a, there's a, you know, people talk about President Bush's loyalty, but, you know, at a certain point, loyalty to one person is an insult to the country, and this is past that with him. But meanwhile, you know, we're getting a look at his Justice Department, and in vital respects, at least in the Civil Rights Division, it's been an injustice department. This week, Hans von Spakovsky, who was the counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, is up for a permanent appointment to the Federal Election Commission. And in testimony, it came out, of course, that he's the man who led, well, you could really call them voters, the voter suppression department at the Justice Department. He aligned the Justice Department with the Georgia Republican Party's attempt to, you know, essentially bring back the poll tax in Georgia, ruled unconstitutional by a federal attorney. No less than six former Justice Department officials have signed letters saying that he was the point man for undermining the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. He intervened against Indian voting, Native American voting in Minnesota. And when asked about these matters in the Senate hearing, he said, I don't remember, which seems to be the classic Justice Department response these days. People just don't remember.
And the president now putting him up for the Federal Election Commission. Richard, look past this president then. You're in the White House. It won't be that long before it has a new occupant. Lots of poll numbers out and money numbers out this week on the race to succeed President Bush. What do you see in those?
Well, the Clinton campaign is bracing for bad news. Bad news meaning, well, they may have raised a truckload of cash, but Barack Obama, we expect, will have raised even more. And if you remember, back in the first quarter, you know, this is the money primary, and to some extent, it's only a sign of popular support, but it's still an important measure. In the first quarter, the Hillary Clinton campaign jumped up and down about the money they had raised and played all sorts of smoke and mirror games because they had lots of cash on hand from her previous Senate campaign. This time around, I think, at least according to fundraisers on both sides of this Democratic divide here, it looks like Barack Obama has really handily won this, both in terms of the money he's raised and the number of donors he's bringing into his campaign.
Steven Spielberg says he's for Hillary, but it's not showing up in the money bottom line there this time.
He's a big guy, but he's only one guy, and there are limits to what even rich people can donate.
And what about on the Republican side? Let's listen for just a moment here. Fred Thompson, he's been floating out there this week while the GOP rustled around. He semi-announced this week he's in the hunt for the Republican nomination with Jay Leno Tuesday night on The Tonight Show.
I've never craved the job of president, but I want to do some things that only a president can do. So the answer is yes.
Yeah, okay, well, that's good.
The answer is yes. The question, a little unclear. Richard Wolff, is it still possible? Is he going to zoom in there? We've got polls putting him, what, right almost neck and neck with Giuliani, and he's not even truly, formally, really announced.
Yeah, look, for someone who is officially not running, he is hiring people and looking like he's running. And I'd just like to say that I've never craved the title of billionaire, but I've always wanted to do the things that a billionaire could do.
So the answer is yes.
The answer is he's running. Of course he's running. You don't go on the Leno show unless you're running.
Yeah. Let's go to Niceville, Florida. Sounds nice. And Lee, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hey.
How you doing?
Good.
My comment is on the border security. That it seems like it's a multifaceted task. With the building of a wall, the electronic security, the laws that govern hiring illegal aliens, it seems like it has to take a multifaceted approach to it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't agree with just the wall. I don't agree with just electronic security. But I do agree with enforcing the laws we already have on the books and doing the others in conjunction.
So, Lee, would you like to see them keep working on a big reform package then, or just drop it and look only at enforcement?
No, I think a reform package needs to be put in place because there's no doubt we're having an influx of illegal aliens from Mexico and other countries. So we need to have that along with the national security as well to govern the laws. But the biggest problem is, you know, it's a tax burden on the country, and the law-abiding citizens are paying for health care and, you know, all sorts of other things for the illegal aliens. If we can get the companies that hire these people to actually pay, you know, their part of the tax, then, you know, that's a big part of it because it releases some of the burden we're absorbing.
Right.
You know, as American citizens.
So do something, but do it right. And thanks very much for that, Lee. Raghita Durgam, I've just got to ask you, you're sitting in New York watching Americans deal with this immigration issue, talking about laws and walls.
Yeah, but
and
it's also something I care about and I follow, so don't worry about it.
Well, how does it look to you? I mean, here you are, Lebanese, from a region with all kinds of problems in its own, and here's a real regional issue in the United States. Mexico and the U.S. side by side, big numbers coming across. How does the debate look to you?
Well, I'm an American citizen to begin with, and I care very much about domestic issues. I am with George W. Bush on the issue of immigration. I'm very keen on making sure that immigration continues to this country because, yes, of course, we get the bad stuff sometimes, but this country would not be what it is if immigration is not upheld in a very respectful manner. I agree with your callers that the walls are not the answer. The laws are to be tightened. And I think here's another example of when people are with a certain administration or a president and or they're against. Sometimes we have this blanket judgment. The same thing applies to, for example, President Bush's situation with the Justice Department. Mm. I think this is something I oppose because exactly of what Richard and Jack spoke about. But the same with the foreign policy. I oppose the administration's policy in that war in Iraq when the Pentagon took over making policy. And I opposed it then, and I thought it was a misleading war, and I still say so. But I am with the American administration's policy vis-a-vis Lebanon. So I think this blanket judgment sometimes blinds us to the necessity to scrutinize important issues such as immigration, such as the Justice Department and the laws. Because people in that part of the world, not only throughout the world, not only through the Middle East, criticize us when we speak of the accountability necessity of laws, and then we are many times doing an ad hoc judgment of what laws apply and where, whether in Guantanamo or somewhere else. And,
right. So look close, follow the nuance. Speaking of judgments and blanket judgments, Richard Wolff, what about Scooter Libby here? The judge said no, he's not staying out of jail while his case is on appeal. He's got threats against himself and his family now. Will the president step in and pardon? What are you hearing out of the White House?
No, I really don't think he will, according to people who've worked with him for a very long time, including those who worked on his pardons back in Texas. There are a couple of criteria, important criteria, that Scooter Libby does not meet, and one of them is expressing remorse and accepting guilt. And the second thing is serving out his time. Those two principles, more than any other, guided then-Governor Bush's approach to pardons in Texas. So
you mean
he really
wants Dick Cheney's man to eat crow and go to jail?
Yes, he wants him to serve his time and then express remorse, and only then might he pardon him.
As he should.
So pardon on the other side of 30 months in jail. It's a long time, but it looks like he may well be headed there. Certainly, at least we'll start there. Wow, what a week. I want to thank each of you. Ragida Durgam with Al Hayat joining us today from New York. It's been great having you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. Always good to have you. Thanks for joining us, Richard.
Thanks, Tom.
Jack Beatty, thanks for being here. Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.